I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you know, on average, heating your home makes up 82% of your energy bill? Installing a smart thermostat could save you a lot of money and be good for the planet. Honeywell Home have been making the home smarter and more comfortable for over 100 years, and their trusted smart thermostats help you get control wherever you are. And because they work with Google and Alexa, you can simply change the heating with your voice. Installing a smart thermostat doesn't have to be confusing or time-consuming, so why not visit getconnected.honeywellhome.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Pocalimp podcast, sponsored by Honeywell Home by Resideo, making the smart home simpler. Amazon has been celebrating following the news that its annual Prime Day sale, which actually lasted 2 days rather than one, was the company's most successful one yet. It sold over 175 million items to customers like you and me, keen to snap up a bargain or two. But what were the big hitters, and does it tell us anything about the future of online retail? Later on in the podcast, I talk to Scott Harvey, editor of Global Dating Insights, about the state of online dating and how it's changing your romantic behaviours. And features editor Britta O'Boyle tells us her top three security cameras for the home, if you want to see what's happening when you're away. So, Dan, let's talk about Prime.
I mean, it was quite an incredible time, really, in terms of how much stuff Amazon shifted. Obviously, you mentioned the 175 million sort of headline figure. You know, they actually sold 100 million items to Prime members that they had existing. Obviously, it's a concentrated time that they have, and they don't have any competition during that time in terms of, you know, other retailers like they were having Black Friday. And they really sold a lot of their own devices. They had new devices like the Echo Show 5, which was half price, basically, and also the Fire TV Stick 4K. They shifted a lot of those. So it was kind of a lot of the top hitters were maybe predictable items, but they were also quite appealing deals this time.
And do you think that's the same? I mean, one of the things that they've said as well is that it was bigger for them than Black Friday. Now, Black Friday has always been this, you know, has been turned very much by the Americans, and now the UK as well, and the rest of the world, very much turned into a big shopping bonanza at the end of November as people get ready for Christmas presents or even just spoiling themselves. And here we are in July, perhaps when people are saving up for their holidays, suddenly thinking, actually, no, I'm going to go and spend £500 on a TV or £1,000 on something else. Do you think that's one of the successes they've had?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've shifted a lot of items that, you know, you wouldn't normally expect them to shift at this time of year. A lot of toys, for example, you know, 1 million toys they sold in the US. You know, that's quite surprising, really. So they've sort of created this event, obviously, for Prime members, but, you know, it's completely separate from that usual September to December Christmas buying period.
And I suppose by doing that, that means that they don't then have they're not fighting other retailers for the competitive deals. You know, obviously Black Friday, as I say, is a good analogy to work toward, you know, as a comparison to work towards, in that sense of on Black Friday, you can go to, in the UK, you know, lots of other retailers in the US, you know, the Walmarts and all the other stuff are doing those as well. Here, were there any other retailers doing sort of Amazon Prime Day deals not for Amazon customers?
There were a few. Google discounted a lot of their Google Home products, as obviously huge competitor to the Echo. So the Home Mini was down to £24 at pretty much every retailer. But Dell have had a big sale this week as well. They've had specific deals on their products. But I'm surprised that more retailers haven't got in on it. Curry's PC World have had a Black Tag event recently, which they tend to do every so often. But you know, retailers like John Lewis, for example, I would have expected them to get in on this time, but they haven't really. Whether that's, I guess, that they find it doesn't work for them, but it is a complaint we often hear around the Black Friday period. that there's too much competition and retailers struggle to get their deals known about, and they're obviously appealing to sites like ours to cover their deals. It would be surely more beneficial for them to be out there with good offers at this time as well.
There were some really good deals this year, and I think that's obviously helped in them. I also think there is this sense of the nice thing about Prime Day was that it's only 2 days long. So you feel like you are getting a deal. And if you have to make that decision to buy it, you've got to be quick about it, because otherwise it goes. Where it does feel sometimes with Black Friday that, you know, it is just a month long experience. And therefore the urgency, the sort of sense of, oh, if I don't buy it now, because you think, well, maybe in 3 or 4 days time, it might even be cheaper. So the big question, Dan, is, did you buy anything on Prime Day?
I actually didn't this time. I was surprised myself. I had a look at a lot of deals, and I was really tempted because Philips had a great deal on one of their OLED TVs, the 55-inch OLED that they put out last year, I think. Did you buy anything?
I'm totally rock and roll on this one. I bought some dishwasher tablets.
Wow.
And I also bought a hard drive. It was a 6 terabyte hard drive. Previously, I think like £200, down to £80. And it just made me feel incredibly satisfied that I now have 6 terabytes of space sitting on my desk, especially more so for reminding me the first hard drive I ever bought was in 1991, two, I think it was. It was 45 megabytes. Just imagine that now. This podcast is probably bigger than 45 megabytes when you start to download it. And that cost me £345. And amazingly, is about the same size as this 6 terabyte drive that's turned up. Still to come, Britt talks us through the best security cameras on the market.
Well, technically, I wouldn't say these are in order, because it actually depends on what system you have at home in terms of Google Home or Alexa. If neither, then it doesn't really matter. All three of these are quite good.
How did you meet your partner? Recent figures suggest that you're more likely to meet the love of your life online than at uni, the pub, or even through friends. I've been talking to Scott Harvey, the editor of Global Dating Insights, an industry trade website that covers the ins and outs of the multitude of dating services that are available today. I spoke to him in his busy office to find out what's happening in the field and what's in store for the future, starting off by asking just how successful online dating is in terms of getting us together with others.
If you're measuring success by marriages, by children, by any of these statistics, it's had a huge, huge impact. So we find around 20% of heterosexual relationships now begin online. It's the most common way for a heterosexual couple to meet, along with meeting someone through a friend. Meeting someone through a bar has gone way down. It's almost been replaced by online dating, is what the stats tend to say from the US and the UK. And that's even more true in homosexual relationships. A huge 75% of homosexual relationships tend to begin online. Usually the explanation for that is that it's the population density is far lower, so these individuals are far more likely to turn to an online platform and meet someone from the next town across. If you're gay, somewhere like Scotland, if you're gay, somewhere like the southwest of England, these apps are incredibly helpful in terms of meeting people, meeting your own community where you live.
Where are we at now? Is It feels like online dating is a thing, but can you just give us a bit of background on what the industry is doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the kind of modern industry as we see it now really kicked off around 2013 with the advent of Tinder. Prior to that, it was very much a kind of senior divorcee user base. Tinder was the first mobile first, 18 to 35 first app. And it was one of the early apps. And this really brought online dating to a whole new generation. I'm 25, so 18 to 35s, my generation, remember it arriving and it completely transforming dating over the course of 5 to 10 years. Since then, because the user base and the target market has expanded so much, the figures have absolutely exploded. So it's now a $5 billion industry in terms of global revenue every year. The biggest company is Tinder's parent company called Match Group. They have a 17 billion market cap. They're about 40% the size of Tesla for comparison. They're about the same size as LG Electronics for a gadget audience. There's Momo in China, who are worth 7 billion. There's the Meet Group and Spark Networks. They're both about 300 million market cap.
So these are big companies.
Big companies. We see hundreds of millions in dollars in acquisitions every year. There was a recent acquisition of Tantan, which is known as the Chinese Tinder. That was a $600 million acquisition. So there's big money moving in this market, and that's kind of epitomized by Facebook entering this time last year. They obviously are a $500 billion company, user base of 3 billion, and they're bringing Facebook dating likely into their main app, and they're trying it in new markets today, they announced.
So there seems to be... That list you just reeled off was, and I'm sure that's not all of them, but that just that feels like a lot of companies. How are they all the same? Is there, I mean, how do you choose your Match.coms from your Tinders, from your OkCupids to whatever? Like, how does that work?
Sure. So one of the main ways the industry divides it up is kind of mainstream versus niche. So we talk about Tinder and Match.com and eHarmony as being mainstream dating sites. Anyone can join, any orientation, any preference. Happy to date anyone, or at least they're open to the idea of dating anyone. There are then several niche sites, so from religious dating sites like JDate, Single Muslim, Christian Connection, to sports dating sites for people who are into fitness, or perhaps you're a rugby fan, you want to join a rugby dating site, there are all kinds of different niche apps. The other way it kind of splits is along generational lines, so some of the more desktop-based dating apps like eHarmony tend to serve a over 35s, over 40s audience, and then the very mobile first ones like Tinder and Bumble tend to be more millennial oriented.
And so that's the sort of state of the market now.
Yep.
Where's the future? Where are we going? Is it embracing technology in huge sways, or is it kind of going to be continuing to be the same for the foreseeable future?
Sure. So we're at something of a turning point at the moment. Tinder, as I said, has completely taken over the world in the last 5 to 10 years. It's a cultural phenomenon. You hear people saying, "I'll swipe right" all the time in tech chat, or just in general, you know, a bar situation. There's, because it's been such a phenomenon, and because it's a $17 billion company, the criticisms of Tinder have now started to come in from a lot of mainstream media sites, tech review sites, these sort of things. The criticisms tend to be that, one, it's too gamified and a little bit addictive for that reason. Tinder uses a kind of variable reward feedback mechanism, so you get a match every fourth swipe, fifth swipe. It's a little bit of a gambling mechanic, so it gets criticized for being engagement first rather than user first. It gets criticized for being shallow, and it gets criticized for being inefficient. Something I always come back to is that it's maybe 20 swipes to get a match, and then you maybe need 5 matches before one of them will say hello, and then you maybe need 5 hellos before you get to a flowing conversation. You need 5 flowing conversations before you get to a date, 5 dates before you get to a second date.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, when you multiply that back up, you are really talking 20,000, 50,000 people before you're on your third date, and if you multiply it back up to, you know, how many faces you're swiping past. So there's a real criticism that it's hideously inefficient from that angle, and that it gives the illusion of user choice and user opportunity, when actually the real prospects on there are quite thin once you get into that, not to use sales language, but the deep funnel of dating, and you're trying to get on your third or fourth date with someone. So it's this kind of inflection point where everyone's accepted that it's a legitimate way to meet a partner. There's a generation of Tinder babies being born at the moment. There's a lot of Tinder marriages coming through. At the same time, the criticisms are starting to come in. So yeah, as you said, the industry is looking to innovate and solve this problem as best it can. One of the ways it's doing that is through AI. So Tinder's parent company, Match, have recently acquired Hinge. Hinge are a very, very AI-focused dating app. They will do things like learn your preferences as you browse through people. They'll learn the kind of things that you like and serve you more of those profiles. There's a We Met button that they recently brought in on Hinge that will figure out if you actually went on a date with the person, and then they can then feed that back into the, you know, machine learning system.
Without you telling them?
You tell them that you met and that you've gone on a date. I think it prompts you if you exchange a phone number, I think. Yeah, and because it then has the data in their back end of who's meeting up and who isn't meeting up, what kind of factors feed into that. It can feed that back around and start to serve really relevant matches, people who are most likely to meet up based on their previous algorithm.
And so do you think we'll get to a point where it's purely you observed people, you know, to see or whatever, purely on AI, in that sense of, you know, there is no serendipity moment in that sense?
Sure. There's a kind of division where there are some apps that take a very AI-focused approach and show that to the user. So you get shown compatibility ratings on something like OkCupid. It'll say, we think you are 87% compatible based on your profile characteristics and your recent behavior on the app. Hinge is mostly users browse freely, but the order in which profiles are shown to you is AI-driven. So they use AI, but not in a way that's obvious to the consumer as you look at it. It just behind the scenes is working to either up your engagement, show you more relevant matches, however you want to phrase it. And then there are some that are pure, just there's no AI in how you browse. You just have a range of profiles and you browse and set your own filters, maybe. Or something.
Now, whenever we always talk about augmented reality and whenever I go to demos and things, there's always this idea of you'll one day be able to put a pair of glasses on, walk into a bar and it'd be like, she's single, he's free, you know, yep. Whatever. Do you foresee dating sites to embrace that? Will that ever happen?
There is a little bit of talk about it. It's one of those things that still sounds a little bit futuristic. But we wrote a story this week, for example, that eHarmony have just renewed their patent for smart watch dating. So your smartwatch will buzz and ping you if someone, you know, on the train carriage with you is also single. You can glance at your smartwatch, see her face or his face, and swipe on your smartwatch, and they'll get a buzz. So I think it's still a little way off, but yeah, the intellectual property is there on eHarmony's side for that. What I think we're closest to at the moment is a more video streaming oriented dating experience. The technology is already there for that. The Meet Group, who I mentioned earlier, they're one of the companies with a 300 million, roughly, market cap. They have a kind of Tinder side to their app, and then they also have a video streaming, almost YouTube-esque side to their app. And their idea is that they want to create a virtual bar environment where if you go into a bar as a customer, you might have a one-to-one chat with someone, or you might be in a group chat with five or six friends, or you might be watching the live entertainment in the corner of the bar, watching the music. So the Meet Group tries to recreate all of this virtually. So there's a kind of virtual live streaming space where people are playing instruments and singing and hosting live quiz shows, and you can go and watch that in one side of the app. And then there's a chat room where you can go and have a kind of forum discussion with 25 other people. And then if you're getting on well with one of those people in the forum, then you can take them to one side and have a one-to-one conversation with them, more in a kind of Tinder type way.
That sounds incredibly complicated.
It is. It's imported over from a lot of the Asian social media sites. So there's a social media site called Momo in Asia that I mentioned. They have a $7 billion market cap, and they have these different kind of social modes all in the same app. So you can use it as a Tinder, or you can use it just as a Facebook, or you can use it as a YouTube. It's all in the same place. It's all the same community, just interacting in different ways with one another.
Now, there's lots of talk as well about DNA testing just in general, with sort of 23andMe and other sort of, you know, ancestry sites and things like that, saying where you've come from and stuff. Do you ever think that that will play into dating as well, in that sense of, oh, we're really compatible according to our DNA results, and we're going to make great children? You know, do you think the appetite is there for that as well?
It's a difficult one to say. A lot of the kind of senior executives at the biggest apps you would have heard of, again, eHarmony, Tinder, Bumble, they aren't that persuaded by the DNA dating case. That might be because the science hasn't been communicated particularly effectively. So the people who are running DNA dating sites tend to be very, very educated on the topic and have a good spiel about compatibility science, and that DNA is one of the main predictors of whether people will end up together, being compatible. There's a big pheromone science as well. There's a dating app called Pheromore that plays on that. There's just a bit of ickiness at the moment, and arguably culture shock, about either taking a swab out of your mouth and sending that away to be analysed, or there's some apps that will send you someone's sweaty t-shirt and you can see if you like their pheromones or not. These things haven't caught on yet. Again, I think because of that ickiness factor, and there's not a general consumer sense that they're a superior way to meet someone. And I don't know what the science says on it exactly, whether there is hard evidence that it's better. There seems to be something to it, but it would be a while until it catches on.
And I suppose the final question I have is with all this data that's floating around, and who you like and who you don't like and who you've been successful with and not successful, privacy must be a massive concern within the industry. Is that something that, with the Me Too industry, you know, Me Too movement and all these different things, are you noticing that within dating sites, that privacy is now a lot more relevant and important than it was, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, so something that happened very, very recently, which is a great example of this, is Kunlun Tech, who are a big Beijing-based conglomerate, have been forced to sell Grindr after they acquired them 2 years ago because the US military is worried that they have the data of which military personnel are gay and then have the leverage, therefore, to bribe them or, you know, manipulate them in other ways because of that. They also have HIV data and a lot of really sensitive personal information that is just too dangerous to be vulnerable either to the Chinese government or to a leak. So as kind of an extension of the Huawei case, yeah, Kunlun Tech has been forced by the US government to sell Grindr, and that will be up on the market very soon, and they'll be acquired by someone back in the US. There are various other privacy concerns that we see. One of them, there was a Chinese data leak recently that had women listing their breed ready status, which was a really horrible sounding bad translation of whether or not they were willing to have children in the near future, and that came out, yeah, again with names, addresses, personal information. And it's worrying because these, the kind of data that dating sites have to operate effectively, tends to be even more personal than the data on social media, on something like Snapchat, on something like LinkedIn. It's really, yeah, your orientation, your preferences, and yeah, it's causing a lot of problems when these things get leaked.
Security cameras are the in thing in the smart home space at the moment, with a number of companies keen to help you keep tabs on your home when you're away. Gone are the days of complex and complicated installs, and in are out-of-the-box solutions that connect to the Wi-Fi in a matter of minutes. But with so many to choose from, and some with monthly subscriptions, which are the best ones to buy? Britta is here with us to tell us more about her top three picks if you're looking for a security camera system for your home or your office. So, Britta, if you could walk us through it, what is your pick for number three?
Well, technically, I wouldn't say these are in order because it actually depends on what system you have at home in terms of Google Home or Alexa. If neither, then it doesn't really matter. All three of these are quite good. So there's Ring, which you might know better for their doorbells. They are owned by Amazon and therefore it works really well with Alexa devices. So if you've got an Echo Show, for example, or an Echo Dot, then either of these will be great. So they do two different ones, Spotlight or Stick-Up Cam. Both have the sort of standard options whereby you have full HD video, night vision, motion detection, two-way talk, and that's actually all without any subscription. But if you want video recording, so video history, if you want to be able to see what's happened in your home, then you'll need the Ring Protect subscription, which is about £2.50 a month. The Spotlight has a few more functions. It's got a light and it's outdoor as well, whereas the stick-up cam can be indoor or outdoor and it's battery or wired, so you have some options there.
Okay, so that's if you've got Alexa, that's probably the best one to go for?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, and what if you've got Google Assistant, if you're a big Google Assistant fan?
If you're a big Google fan, then Nest would be the best one, unsurprisingly, given that Google owns Nest. They work seamlessly together. They're brilliant together. I've got Google Home and you can sort of ask it to show you your living room, for example, if you've got a Nest Cam IQ in your living room or a Nest Cam indoor, and it will straight away show up. No, you don't even have to wait, really, because you have to have the Nest Aware subscription to get the best features. Nest Cam IQ has person detection and familiar face detection, so it will tell you if your mum's in the living room or your partner's in the living room and so forth. But you do need to pay for that, which is £4 a month per camera. That also has two-way talk, night vision, a great app experience, and really nice and easy to use as well, which is nice. It's also really good if you've got Nest Thermostat or any other Nest devices. They also do a video doorbell.
Cool. So that's if you've got Alexa and you've got Google, is there an option? Do you have to have those? Can you get a decent security camera system without being reliant upon the others?
You don't need either Alexa or home devices for either of those, but they are a nice addition. It's a nice, it works quite well together. There's also Arlo, which actually works with both. Probably one of the best systems out there because it's a security-based system. So they're all about cameras with additional products coming into the system, as opposed to being about other products and then having a camera as well. Arlo is more of a modular system. They also have lots of different options. So there's the Arlo Ultra, which is 4K recording. It's most expensive, but it offers great video quality, obviously. There's also sort of Arlo Go, which has an LTE connection. So that's great for if you have a garden and you're not, it's not that close to your Wi-Fi router, or if you've got a gate, for example. But they've got devices in between too, such as the Arlo Pro 2, which is probably the one we'd recommend because you get a few more features, better video quality. Some of the lower options have 720p, whereas the Arlo Pro range has full HD, which so you'd have a clearer view. And you also get 7 days of video history without a subscription. So that's great. You do pay a little bit extra if you do pay the subscription if you want sort of zones, which is something that Nest offers as well, but you don't necessarily need it if you just want to see your video recordings and you don't want the extra features. Then you basically pay for the camera and the hub, and that's that.
If you were to pick one to go with, which would be your top choice?
Oh, that's tricky. I mean, I've got Nest and I absolutely love it, but Arlo is probably more flexible in terms of placement because there's battery operated devices which Nest doesn't have, and it's probably slightly cheaper in the long run when it comes to if you mount up the cost of the monthly subscriptions and stuff. So I'd say Arlo is the most flexible out there in terms of features for the price.
Well, that's it for this week's show. New episodes of the Pocalimp podcast will arrive every Friday with more news, interviews and buying guides for you to enjoy. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please let your friends and colleagues know. And please rate us on a podcast platform you're listening on. It really will help others know you like it too. Until next Friday, pip pip.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.